Hello, and welcome to the latest episode of Who Do You Think You Are? The brand new podcast series by A3 Communications, the data storage industry PR agency. My name is Fred Monson, and I'm A3 Communications founder and CEO. Today, I am joined by Evelyn Ehrlich, Chief Research Officer at the DevOps Institute and Research Director and Industry Analyst at Research in Action. Good morning, Evelyn. Thank you for joining us today. How are you?
I'm great, and good morning to you. I am having a very good day today.
Excellent. So just for our listeners who may not be familiar with you, I'd just like to give a little bit of background about you. So today you've held a number of senior analyst and advisor positions in the industry, including VP and Research Director at Forrester. You've also covered various spaces, including DevOps, digital operational excellence, enterprise service management, application performance management, IT automation, and many others. Can you tell our listeners, what are your areas of focus today?
Yes, as you said, DevOps is certainly one area which is a best practice or developed practice of bridging the developers and operations. That includes many, many things. It includes people, processes, and of course, automation tools. So one thing I focus on is the skills which are needing to be developed relative to the DevOps practices. Then I focus on the processes or principles which are within DevOps. And then, of course, many, many different tools are leveraged in DevOps from the IT automation space, be it tools around application performance management, AI ops, enterprise service management, ticketing, service desks, and many, many more.
Goodness, definitely quite a few areas of focus there. So why did you become an analyst? Why did you choose to look at the market from this angle? And how long have you been an analyst?
Yeah, so the latter question is the easier one to answer. I've been an analyst since 17 years. I started at Forrester Research in 2006 in October. I still remember the day and the month. It was one of those changes in my career, which has really defined my life since then. I lived in the US, and as I was working at a very large technology company in the software business, I was a marketing manager and saw a lot of competitors because I was responsible for the competition and giving advice to our leaders and our salespeople how to win against the competition. And that's really where I think I started to define myself as an analyst, because I really was curious about how do these vendors all beat us, or how do the other enterprises perceive our competition. And so one day, with a glass of wine, I decided to apply for a job at Forrester Research. And 2 weeks later, voila, I get a call. And 2 weeks later, voila, I got a job offering as a senior, not so senior, industry analyst in the topic of IT automation. And since then, I have been staying in that profession. I'm a very passionate analyst. I don't know what anything else to do besides cook. And that, unfortunately, doesn't feed the college fees for my kids. Oh. And so I have stayed in that profession since, and I love it.
Oh, well, it sounds like Forrester was very, very pleased to have you if you got the job in a month. So what do you think makes someone a good analyst and vendor advisor? Because it's not just about researching the market. It's also in putting that research and the findings into actionable advice for vendors, for organizations that come to you and say, Evelyn, we have this issue. How can we address it? So what do you think makes a person a good analyst and vendor advisor?
I think it is digging through the noise on both sides of the formula. Let's put it this way. When I say formula, there are enterprise clients at all levels, C-level, individual contributors, leaders, who need to solve a problem. Listening to what their problems really are is the first thing. And then on the vendor side is to listen through, let's call it the marketing language of the vendors, because they always do everything, including cleaning the kitchen, taking the kids to work, to school, and all of that, right? And so making that connection between what you know your clients, enterprise clients need, and transferring that into what the vendors offer and making that connection. And while you're doing that, helping both to develop practices, messaging, offering solutions which are powerful but easy to automate whatever these things are the client has in terms of challenges. I think listening is the first one. And then the second one, of course, is to be brief. And that's a challenge for many analysts. Be brief and to be actionable. And that just comes with practice. In the first year, that's the hardest thing to do because you want to do everything. But you really have to hone in, be brief, focus, and drive on actionable activities.
Absolutely. So over the past 17 years, we've just learned. So you've helped an array of enterprises, both large and small, and you've helped them navigate changes to their personnel, processes, technologies. Based on your experience, are there any challenges? And I'm thinking both about vendors and end users. Are there any challenges that you see recurring time after time?
People, humans, culture, egos. You know, you can actually automate anything and you can learn almost any technology. People in IT, people in the vendor space and in the enterprise are extremely smart. They're very motivated. They love shiny new objects. And a colleague of mine actually does a lot of things around the topic of shiny new objects. But what they have a challenge with is to emphasize the human nature of what needs to be done and step away from their egos or their silos or their shiny object and kind of look practical. And so I hear stories from enterprise clients where I roll my eyes on the telephone. I'm glad we have no cameras sometimes because it is really not a challenge around the technology. It's a challenge about collaborating, communicating, having empathy, doing interpersonal connections, understanding visions, understanding goals. There's so much misalignment, and that has not gone away. I do think the pandemic has helped us to get a little bit out of this, hey, you over there don't know what's happening, or I know better than you, because we have kind of all been in a crisis together. But I'm seeing, based on the data we're just analyzing, that we're moving back into what was before the pandemic, the normal way of, hey, I'm here and I know what to do and I'm going to go down my path. And that's not working. And that's just a challenge of human nature, I think.
That is so interesting because often IT vendors focus their message all around the technology. And especially when you have companies coming together, you know, an acquisition, a merger, you need to make sure that the cultures align, because otherwise I think the least of your problems is going to be technology. It's going to be the integration of people and processes. Absolutely. I think you've hit the nail on the head there. So many of our listeners are vendors, right? The vendors based in the US. I'm sure they'd like to know from someone like you with so much experience, both in the US and in the DACH space, what are the main differences between the DACH market and the US market when it comes to how a vendor should position themselves, how they should approach the sales process, how, you know, maybe from the end user side, the pain points, that kind of thing. Is it very different? And if so, how?
So from a top down, it isn't really very different. When I think of a large enterprise in, let's say, Germany or Austria or Switzerland, and this could be one which goes across all of those areas, there are challenges around hybrid cloud management, the challenges around reducing toil, automating workflow, getting efficient, resilient, secure are the same. The speed is a little bit different. I would say in DACH, particularly, the speed by which innovation is brought into an organization and by which and how things are being changed is slower because there's a lot more bureaucracy. It's just the way it is. In Germany, for example, the digital transformation in Germany hasn't progressed as fast as it has in the US. It's because of there's legal councils, there is all kinds of different challenges in around bureaucracy, and you need to have a burst through the depths of the organization, which is rather deep. That's, I think, one difference. Where in the US, you have many times flat organizations, changes, people are more open to change, there's not as much bureaucracy. I think another challenge or another difference, I would say, and that's not bad or you know, good or bad, it's just different. The purchasing decisions here in Europe, the budget responsibilities and the budget which somebody might have as an oversight might not be as large. So a vice president might be able to decide for 200,000, where in the US it might be maybe 350,000 or less, right? Kind of like that. And then the German or the DACH folks specifically are very they're very detailed. So how a salesperson, a technical salesperson, a pre-sales person approaches the sale, it requires much more details and much more patience and maybe a little more technical details than it does in the United States. And so that's sometimes a big challenge for vendors who do global campaigns when there is a lot of marketing and blah, 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 and fluff and exposition, all that. That's really great. That's all fancy and nice. Many Europeans or many DACH people say, oh, yeah, yeah, right. I don't get it. You need to be serious. Tell me what's the price. Tell me what I get. Tell me how long it takes. I don't believe that. I think they're much more critical than some of the US enterprises I've worked with.
That's really interesting because we see that because we support clients in the US and in Europe. And in Europe, we have feet on the ground in the DACH market. And often we have to explain to them, even just from the messaging, from the comms side, that doing communications in Germany is very different to the way they do that in the US. You know, I once said to a client, you know, in the US, people buy because they're excited. In Europe, they buy because they're convinced. You know, you can't just get them really, really excited about something and hope that's enough. You need facts. You need white papers. You need analyst papers. You know, you need something that has a solid foundation in order to be taken seriously. So would you have one top tip for a US-based vendor who wants to break into DACH for the first time? Say they've only ever sold in the US, they want to break into the DACH market. What's your top tip? Where should they start or what should they do or not do?
Yeah, there's actually two things. One, there should be immediate executive relationships established, and that not necessarily just at the sales level, but also at the highest level of the vendor management. So, for example, company X has a high-level individual who could come over and really meet the C-level of the enterprise, no matter if it's a small or large or if it's a nonprofit, government, whatever. I think a relationship with the vendor and having that shaking of hands or that the knuckles, right, today, face-to-face or in a video, if possible, is extremely important. That's number one. And then number two, I think, as you already said, it's the value equation. And that can't be fluff and exposition value. It really means how much can you save us in terms of workload, in terms of efficiency improvements, in terms of actionable or details around security or resiliency, and there needs to be a euro sign or a Swiss franc sign behind it. And then, of course, with that, other customers who have leveraged that. So, and they can't be somewhere in Timbuktu. They have to be somewhere here. So creating that customer reference program with referenceable customers in the region who have shown outcome and value. I think those are the three things I would highly recommend to do breaking into the DACH market.
That's excellent. That is such valuable advice, Evelyn. Thank you. So we touched on this earlier. You tend to cover quite a large breadth of technologies. How do you make sure you keep on top of what's happening in the industry, how things are changing? Do you like to do vendor briefings? Do you go to trade shows where vendors are? How do you keep on top of what's going on in the industry?
Yeah, so the first one, of course, is briefings. I love briefings. I always offer some little snippets for free to vendors. Sometimes I just tell them, hey, the messaging, I would change that. So I love those because I get to meet them and actually connect with product marketing and product management folks. I do go to events, not as much lately. And then I do my own research, of course. I do desk research. I do a lot of reading on the different trends. I do look at the competition. I do look at Gartner. I look at what Forrester is writing about. I look at all the other market research companies, what they do. I look at or listen to some of the companies I follow on their year-end or quarter performance reports, such as ServiceNow, which just had a great year again. But it's a challenge. It's a very filled day with lots of reading, but including briefings. And then, of course, I have to deliver. I do a lot of thought leadership research and write papers and things like that as well. And it's a challenge, but it's fun. I love it.
Oh, well, it certainly sounds like you love it. As you said, you're very passionate about this, and it comes across. And I think that's important because I think analysts get so deep into a topic that if they don't love it, they will run for the hills very quickly because the type of job you have, the type of work you do really demands commitment to the cause in a way. So what do you find most interesting about the DevOps market today?
I think it is the change in how these different constituencies in IT are starting or have started to work, right? I mean, the word DevOps, the combination of dev and ops, you go back to a session we had once. I have to tell you that it's as funny as I think it was 10 years ago when my colleague Len O'Donnell and I were saying in the room, please separate yourself between dev and ops. So the left-hand side is dev, the right-hand side is ops. And then we said, stand up and shake hands. And these people were very resistant, it's like they're almost scared of each other. And so I think that's the beauty that we're finally seeing that we all in no matter which silo, we have our own silo, of course, because we have the developers, they are knowing what they're doing, but they need to look up from their desk and need to look over and reach out to the operations people, the enterprise architects, the infrastructure folks, and only through that reaching out and from the other side as well, only reaching out from ops to dev can we improve. And I think that's the most beautiful thing in this nature of DevOps is starting to expand. We're seeing DevSecOps, we're seeing DataOps, we're seeing ModelOps, we're seeing all kinds of combinations, two or three or four combinations to break out of those silos. And that's exciting because that really, I think, is reshaping. I would almost say it's revolutionizing how we work in IT deliver outcomes to the business, because IT is business today. We know it. IT is not separate. Without IT, a company cannot function. Without IT, you and I wouldn't be talking. And I think that's like melting us together. But at the same time, we need to be more practical and more decisive and specific about how we go into the future by reaching out to the silo next to us.
Absolutely. And that is such an interesting point that you made, the fact that sometimes we have silos of information of teams in a company, and that can be a huge problem because sometimes you actually have an issue in multiple areas, but because they don't talk to each other, they don't know. And so they try, every one of those tries to find a solution, and it would be so much quicker, easier, less painful and cheaper if they all work together. That is very, very true. So has it always been like that, though? How has the DevOps market changed since you started working in it?
Yeah, we've been in it now since, if you look back, 2008, I think, was the beginning. It has changed in terms of a number of tools which are there. There are an incredible amount of tools which are automating all kinds of things. It has changed in terms of its attention in the level of organizations. It's no longer the geeky thing to do at the low level. It's not a green field. It moves into and has moved into the C-level, has gotten the attention of IT leaders and so on. I think that second and third, it has created sub-markets or let's say sub-topics. For example, site reliability engineering, I would say, is something which stems out of or has come out of both service management and DevOps, because it is an engineer who has the ability to automate a variety of tasks, processes, and decisions between the teams there. So it's changed quite a bit in adoption, in visibility, and in tools. It hasn't as gone as fast because it is changing culture. And I think if I would, you know, I have to say and give a summary on it, we still are in it. We will never be done. It still needs a lot of attention. It still needs lots more measurement and outcomes. I do hope that before I retire, which who knows when that will be, that it becomes the way of normal, the way of now, and not the way of something we are aspiring to, but it really becomes the way we do our work in a day-to-day perspective.
That's interesting. So how do you see it changing then? We've looked at the way it's changed in the past. How do you see it changing in the future? Both in the DACH region or Europe and the US, for example, will they change in different ways, or will, as time goes on, will it become just one big market with very similar pain points, very similar ways of selling? What's in store for the DevOps market, say, over the next 5 years?
Yeah, I think there's one topic which is essential. I mentioned that already, that the term of value, which sometimes is interpreted in different ways, right? Depending on who I am, what is value? Well, value is if I improve an outcome for somebody on something, or if I an outcome could be efficiency in terms of flow. It could be security in terms of an edge. It could be insight in terms of data. And so I think what's happening right now with the term value and the topic of value stream management, that is kind of an uber topic around the term DevOps in itself, because a lot of folks in the value stream, beginning from those who are in the business, say, I need some new features, some new functions of an application, to those who are delivering it and those who are operating it, are all needing to prove that whatever they do is improving something of value. And so a broader movement right now is to bring these different types of capabilities and value streams and journeys together to see how are we improving the different steps, the different tasks, the different processes, the different outcomes we're looking at, and we need the data. And so everything is focused on right now, everything has been focused on processes and improvements on flow. What I think the next step is looking at the data and bringing the data together, observing it and understanding it, and from there deriving improvements on whatever waste or improvements in terms of flow or value or whatever we have. And I think that's a beautiful conversation, because that means that we're all pushing or pulling on the same end.
You certainly know the market very, very well, Evelyn. How do you tend to help vendors? Let's think about vendors for a moment rather than vendors and end users. Say some of our listeners have never worked with you, but they like what they are hearing. They like the fact that you know the industry so well. What could you do for them? You know, say they want to get a better strategy in terms of selling in this market, or they want to break again into the DACH region. How can you help them? What would you be able to bring to the table for a vendor?
Yeah, so the first thing is a strategy review. I mean, that's number one. I would want to have a conversation with whoever owns their strategy. And I would typically, that's maybe a 2-hour conversation, video. They share the slides. I would give input to the strategy upon reviewing that. And I would look at, you know, how are you going to market? What is your execution capability? How is your viability? What's your messaging like? Are you going to the right target market? Et cetera, et cetera. So that's a presentation they would give to me for 2 hours, and I would come back with a variety of ideas and suggestions. Once that's done, they probably will have to adjust some of their things. Maybe not. Maybe they're great. But I would suggest then the next step would be a messaging review, as they have changed their messaging, and do another, you know, second round. Maybe it's an hour. And then third could be a thought leadership piece. There are many, many vendors who I have worked with. They just don't know how to present to the end customer. Like, let's say it's site reliability and topic, and they're doing something in observability. They might not know what are the trends in a particular area for a particular topic, et cetera, et cetera. So we would do data surveys with end users. We do some trends, and out of that comes the thought leadership paper, which is, you know, could be 2, 4, well, however many pages. And then we also do return on investment studies, which is really understanding what are the value drivers you have. Are those value drivers really justified? Are they supported? We do interviews with 3 customers. We calculate the value drivers in terms of details, and then we create a, we call it an ROI study, which then can be leveraged by sales to prove that they're actually doing and can do what they're saying they're doing.
That's certainly very, very interesting. And I would encourage many of our listeners looking to find out more about the DevOps space to talk to you, because it sounds like you have a much more in-depth knowledge of this space than most of the people that I have spoken to. So thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. So in your opinion, looking ahead at just 2023, you know, the next 12 months, what do you think will be the most interesting developments in DevOps for vendors? If vendors, what should they focus on this year when it comes to maybe positioning, messaging, tech development? What do you think, what would your advice be for vendors for 2023?
How can you prove that DevOps can actually reduce budgets or save budgets? Because we know we are either in a recession already or we are continuing to go into. IT budgets are very, very tight. There is tons and tons of challenges in the C-level of organizations laying off people. IT is still protected, but there might be a wave where in IT people are being laid off as well. So really prove to your constituencies that you actually can bring something to the bottom line of the business. You can improve flow by 20%, 10%. You can reduce you can automate workflows to shift people into other tasks which are more beneficial. You can reduce mundane tasks, et cetera, et cetera. And there needs to be a dollar figure to that. There needs to be a value proposition, which can be proven. If you can't do it, it's going to be tough to make the sale for the IT people to their business, because the budget is still coming from the business. IT in many organizations is still seen as a cost center and not a profit or a break even, unfortunately.
Excellent. That's it for this episode of A3 Communications, Who Do You Think You Are? Thank you for joining us today, Evelyn. To find out more about Evelyn, you can visit researchinaction.de. To find the list of podcasts in this series, you can go to a3communicationspr.com. I'm Fred Monson. Thank you for listening, and see you in our next episode of A3 Communications, Who Do You Think You Are?